This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location today with Terry Blackhawk, who is a Detroit, Michigan poet, and she's come to us via Connecticut. And here she is with an opening poem.
Thank you. This poem is very timely because of the recent charges that have been lodged against a number of officials in Flint, Michigan, charges of manslaughter because of the death of a gentleman from Legionnaires' disease due to the poisoning of the Flint River that happened in 2014. This poem is titled, "The Ivory Gull Under the Bridge Over the Flint River." A couple of things about it. Sibley is a bird expert. When you look to identify birds, you look for Sibley. The term bird while comes from my friend Keith Taylor, who used it as a title of his book, and he took it from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who coined it to say that a bird while is the amount of time you have to see a bird before it flies off to another branch. Keith posted a photo on Facebook of this beautiful white gull, and in this very slimy setting. So here again, I'll give you the title, and there are a few borrowings in here from Walt Whitman. "The Ivory Gull Under the Bridge Over the Flint River. The insignificant is as big to me as any." Walt Whitman. "Near threatened, accidental, the gull, winged, meandered its ivory way thousands of miles from the Arctic here to Flint, Michigan, where it sat on the dam spillway, insignificant, yet as big to us as an omen. Hundreds flocked to photograph, pluck its glimmering name from the slimy dark concrete where the poisoned water flows. No less than the journey work of stars, bright migrant, I'm still yearning to see, or one like it, a razor-billed auk or snowy owl, the pristine ice fields they hail from, receding now, while all the bird whiles I've savored shimmer in memory and grief against this bleak industrial stage my friend captured on film, the bird later found dead there." Sibley, quote, "The one pure white gull, plumage dazzlingly white, often very tame, voice a mewing high whistle, strongly descending. Am I wrong to think of Eurydice at Hades' throne, bird as halcyon respite? Great monsters are lying low, in vain the buzzard houses herself against the sky. Never mind the sickened children of the town."
The voice of Terry Blackhawk. We're at the Library of Congress, but we're on location. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I love the way you frame a horrific event with the beauty of the bird. And now you're a Detroit poet. I actually met you there 40 years ago, and I think I remember you first as a teacher. So my question is, having taught many years, and I watched you from a distance, when you look back, now that you're retired, what is the one thing that you've learned from your students?
I guess it's a sense of courage and openness. That's what I really wanted from them, and I think I found that more than I could have expected.
And that informs your own work, and so hearing that, we're going to go on to the next poem.
Thank you. This is another river poem. This mourns a friend lost by suicide, and the names of the creatures in here were taken from an exhibit in the Belle Isle Nature Center. Belle Isle is a beautiful island park in the middle of the Detroit River, larger than Central Park, and it's where a lot of us go for refreshment and respite. "The extinct freshwater mussels of the Detroit River." For Katherine Lindbergh, 1951 to 2010. "These are gone, the deer toe maple leaf, the fat mucket, the snuff box, the rainbow shell. Here still the rusted manhole cover and the chipping paint, the lights and arches of the elegant bridge, all coated no doubt then in ice. Here the breeze, here the freighters, but not the car. quiet as it's kept, it's no secret the keys were left in the ignition. Absence makes the fond heart wander, the mind meander, the river to swallow its flow, the self-same river, the self-same self, even the one that knew better, the self that knew better than to pick up a phony $10 bill folded to disguise some evangelical come hither. Come hither, said the bridge. Little earwig muscle, pimple back, northern riffle shell, something lacy yet along the rim. In the print gallery, a dry point fox in outline, running fox, Ars in Temi, Germany, 1944, floats as if on the surface of a river, water swelling upward on the verge of breaking up its lines. Did you float, dear bat out of hell, dear gnashing teeth, the pointed ears, the flowing tail outlined on water, not water, on paper, not paper, on the not water before there only was water, where we are floating now, as over a great uncertainty, a mirroring surface that hides as much as it reveals. Mm. No more rayed bean, purple warty back. Oh, fragile paper shell, where was the artist in 1944? What did he do in 1939? You would have wanted to know.
What is that poem about?
Well, it certainly mourns the loss of my friend who was a fierce, fierce fighter for justice. And it also mourns the loss of our ecology, because all of those beautiful names of those beautiful mussels, they're all gone, and they've been replaced by zebra mussels, and, you know, the ecology has been damaged in the Great Lakes because of the ships that come up through the St. Lawrence, and they release their bilge water, and so these mussels that have no natural enemies have taken over, and all those beautiful creatures are gone.
Terry Blackhawk, what I love the most is that you take a rough, difficult subject and convert it to such elevated language. What I loved most about that poem was how you turned one phrase within another phrase. Sometimes poets turn a corner somewhere in the poem. You do it within the line. You turn corners within the line. And apparently other people like you too, because Terry is the author of 3 chapbooks, 4 full-length collections, and The Escape Artist was chosen by Molly Peacock for the John Chardy Prize. We have The Dropped Hand, The Light Between. They are from Wayne State University Press. She's a Motor City poet. And you have won many awards, Foley Poetry, the Springfield Arts, the Pablo Neruda from Nimrod, which is really very good. And you've been, I'm sure, published in hundreds, and I still keep seeing you in all of these magazines currently. So you're really a practicing artist. And because we're getting to know her, we're going to press her for more and more until we finally find out what are her themes.
This poem harkens back to my childhood. And I think one of my themes is justice. And I think that came through in the last couple of poems. I was a transplant as a child. We moved from Massachusetts to Georgia. So I grew up largely in the Jim Crow South, and we were in the South, as I like to say, but not of it. Mm. So we were constantly kind of outsiders in this realm. So this is a poem that riffs off Walt Whitman, a quote from Walt Whitman, who Whitman tried to soothe both sides after the Civil War, and I take issue with that. And this is called To Sing in Dixie, and I'd like to give a shout out to John Sims, who's an activist, a fellow Antioch College grad, who has been staging performances to A, burn the Confederate flag, which he did last month in Detroit, and also take down the anthem Dixie. So this was part of his project called the Afro-Dixie Remix, where he had poets write poems, and then they were performed along with renditions of Dixie. Mine was performed alongside a jazz rendition, but he also had hip-hop, he had reggae, he had the blues. So very, very lively and challenging man. To Sing in Dixie. And it starts with this quote from Walt Whitman. A southerner soon as a northerner, a planter, nonchalant and hospitable, down by the Oconee I live. Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, 16. Red clay clotted our shoes, rain eroded the soil. Nothing would grow for us in Dixie. We did not belong, yet there we were, a northern family sent in the 50s to Dixie. Because in first grade in Cambridge I loved a black boy, Roland, I told my new classmates in Dixie. The mill workers' children would not play with me. I lined up pebbles in the playground that entire year in second grade in Dixie. But then Arrow comforted me. Joseph helped me find a new dog. I remember their kindness, the warmth of black folk in Dixie. In seventh grade, Mr. Light wore terrible ties, lined up our desks to match the stars and bars of Dixie. Choked raspberries, roses, ornamental trees, a garden overgrown since the Civil War was my playground in Dixie. Across the road was an antebellum mansion. Sherman slept there. Had nonchalant planters roamed my woods in Dixie? Oh, Walt, cataloger of farmers, mechanics, artists, gentlemen, for planters, why not say slavers and name the scourge of Dixie? In ninth grade, I argued with classmates about the Old South, but in how many ways was I infected by Dixie? How to tell the land from the blood that ran through it? Spring dogwoods are lovely in Dixie. You would still be who you are, my mother said, when I wondered, what if I had been born into Dixie? I watched the Klan on TV, Mamie Till's grief. I remember numbness, my fear and confusion in Dixie. In 10th grade Latin, the whole class sang, Volam esse in terra sippi. It was the land of cotton. It was Dixie. Whitman wanted to soothe both sides with cornets and drums to beat and pound the same for the victor, the slain in Dixie. But the war rages on. Tamir, Sandra, Trayvon, thousands gone. Terry, you cannot breathe, let alone sing in Dixie.
Terry Blackhawk is the poet in the poem. What makes that poem is the tie, the teacher wore, and lining up the pebbles, because those little specific acts are so true to the poem. And they really highlight, we are right there with you in that classroom and in the playground. Other than social action, what do you think some of your themes are in your whole canon of work you've been writing now since the 60s, 70s? 80s. Oh, the 80s, okay. So after you graduated from Antioch College, it took you 20 years to find out you were a poet. Mm-hmm. So what is in your canon of work, looking at it, what are you always saying?
That's a little hard to pin down. One thing that always, though, captures my imagination is birds. And there are various themes that have recurred through my work. Early on, I wrote about women's identity through mythology. I was very fascinated by and influenced by Margaret Atwood's work, her Siren Song, some of those poems. Birds have been a big, big exploration for me. And I think part of what I love about writing a poem is that you lose yourself. So you just go, I lose myself often in nature, and I lose myself in my poems. And another theme for me is visual art. I have been doing ekphrastic, as they now say, writing for a long time. And I got fascinated by the paintings of Emily Carr, the famous, the Canadian, kind of very eccentric painter. So it's a range. I mean, different kinds of things will spur me or start me going.
Terry Blackhawk, I'm Grace Cavalieri. One thing that you're well known for is something called Inside Out Literary Arts Project. And that's an indentation you made on the world that apparently is going to be permanent. So I would love to hear about the impetus of that and how you initiated the project and what it is and what's happening.
Great, thank you. Well, I didn't discover myself as a poet until the 80s when I was teaching high school in Detroit. And that was connected with my excitement about being a poet myself was fueled by my excitement about teaching poetry to my students in Detroit. And so for several years, I was part of a project where in our classrooms at Mumford High School, we would bring in poets. We would put out a literary magazine. And I was one of the leaders of that. So that morphed, just kind of a long story, but I was able to attract the attention of a patron who wanted to do some philanthropy and asked me if I would like to take this work, which I had been doing in my classroom, and make a citywide project out of it. So that was really life-changing. I didn't know what I was getting into, but this gentleman, Bob Shea, was a very kind philanthropist and helped me start a nonprofit. So I ran that for several years out of my classroom while I was teaching full-time, but we were experimenting with four or five different schools where we would, the core program was bring in live living poets and get the kids excited about writing and publish and celebrate their work. So that has grown into a large program. It's been going now 20 some years. I founded it in 1995. I retired in 2015. But we've got so many fabulous programs going on with the program. It's Inside Out Literary Arts Detroit. We're in like 25 to 30 schools a year where the poets go in. Every school gets its own book, its own separate publication. And there are variations on themes. So we have one project where we have anti-bullying going on through poetry in schools. We have classrooms where we bring in songwriters to work with the poets. And then we have a powerful spoken word program called Citywide Poets, which I started in 1998. And it has grown to be a real presence in not just the city, but also around the country, where the kids go to the Brave New Voices Poetry Slam. And that whole energy has just really kind of transformed the organization itself.
I believe poetry can change the world. I know that this sounds like an abstraction in this world of power, greed, and betrayal, but I just think Detroit was a mecca for your work, and I know it's going to just be contagious forever. So Terry Black Hawk is here with her world, her story, bringing it to us from Detroit and via Connecticut. So let's have another poem.
Okay. This poem is from quite some years ago, and it was, I mentioned ekphrastic work, so art can inspire poetry.
What does ekphrastic mean?
Ekphrastic means the representation of a visual image, a work of art, in poetry. It goes back to Homer's description of the shield of Achilles, and it's a very highfalutin term, and people do it whether they know they're doing it or not.
They look at a picture.
And they write about it, basically, yeah. So this was a documentary that kind of just knocked me over when I saw it. It was on Frontline quite some years ago. It's called Burmese Girls Sold into Prostitution in Thailand. And I have a quote from one of the girls. "We make our story something to envy, so we are not left with nothing. In order that her parents not go deeper into debt, she does not kill herself. She is the bargain, the chip. She evens the odds, even though she cannot speak the language, Thai. It misaligns her tongue, sounds oily to her ears, the tongues of men, the forcing of them, hundreds, thousands, how many places can they find on her? The body has only so many openings, and she loses value quickly. Once, twice, maybe three times, she can be passed off as a virgin, even as she faints, even as she counts the bricks in the windowless walls, corridors where she never sees the sun, unless to settle the madam's score. She is arrested, hauled out from the underground cells. Then only the quiet ones are not redeemed the ones who do not know how to smile at men, but she is ransomed back to the metal bed, the cement floor. The men again and again, especially the drunks, frighten her. So she feels nothing, nothing when the child moves inside her, nothing when the poison she takes flattens her belly so that another girl will never be born to turn 11 or 12 into nothing of value but the stories she makes, even when the fatigue claims her and she is coated with sores and sent back to her village where she is whispered about, no friends, nothing but these mascaraed eyes, this fringed cloth, embroidered with tales of luxury rides, bringing the city to the village in a voice hardened to the waste the man in her dreams who appears dressed in red brings. Until fevers overtake her and her mouth turns dry and she is so thin the wind blows through her until she is parched, barely bones, and so little flesh left for the pyre. But they burn her body anyway, let flames rise around her, her heel the strongest glowing coal, a searing eye watching back at them a long time as they burn all that is hers, the city clothes, the plastic shoes, the drinking cup.
Once again, poetry elevates. Once again, you can take a sordid subject and just by virtue of the tenderness of vowels and consonants and change that visual into something which I can only say art saves. Art saves. And I believe that it's made better than the documentary. When we spoke before we went on microphone, you said, I wonder if I own this. What does that mean?
Well, I wonder if, you know, if I have the right to this poem. I mean, it's like, is it an act of appropriation to show my compassion, which I feel very genuinely, through something that is not my experience?
Well, this is why a writer is one who leads a moral life, because these are questions we're always facing, the ethics of writing. And I think just that you raise that shows the integrity of poetry. And the fact that you name it in your book, you identify it, where you got this, and you transform it, I think you made it better than it was. But I like very much your rumination and questioning yourself. But I think that you own this as much as the documentary worker does. And I believe in spiritual intention. Was your intention to make money from this? Was your intention to vilify her? Was your intention to judge her?
Of course not, no. And I like the parallel with the documentarian because it's to show the world what kind of serious injustice goes on. Before I started writing poetry, and I did have this kind of lightning bolt strike me at a certain point where I had not been writing before, but I had been teaching in a creative manner, and one of the things that nourished my teaching was storytelling. And I, in fact, worked with a marvelous storyteller named Laura Sims on a storytelling retreat, and I found that similar to my exploration in myth, the exploration of story nurtured my imagination. So this is a poem that comes from the act of telling stories to a classroom. And when you are telling a story, you say to the students or the children, let me see your eyes, because everyone is in the storytelling trance and everyone is creating their own story. And that's what's so powerful about it. You know the imaginations are all doing their own particular creative act while you're telling. So this little poem mentions a few stories that I loved to tell, an Icelandic sealskin story, an African story called The Cowtail Switch. It's called What the Story Weaves, the Spinner Tells. When I look out from inside the dream and the space of the dream shines between us, I see you there shining on the other side. The dream is a tale, a story I tell, drawing us into a new space, encircling us in common light. When everything vanishes but the light of memory, what will protect us inside our lines, this darkly echoing space? Will it be the red handprint of our dreams hovering over our heads, this thread of a tale raveling, or the way I see your eyes shining? Fisherman, you haul your nets in the shining evening, your straining limbs pollinated by light. Princess, you descend from the tower into the tale, crumple, rise, redressed, victorious. Inside our story, we do not live in grace, but dream of transformation, a new path to that open space in the grasses where we reassemble our bones, pace backward, then reclaim the panther whose shining teeth dismembered the dimensions of our dream. Third child, Grimm's little girl, had it right. Light is the only way to fill us from the inside out. The match in her apron pocket, the tail a bright window against the black forest. We tell and grow new with every telling, amazed by the space we shape, the way we regard one another inside it.
The bright window in the dark forest. Let us have a final poem.
This poem is called Ice Music, and it again goes back to Belle Isle and the Detroit River. It's exactly 100 words long, which was just kind of a delightful challenge that a dear departed friend named George Adilla gave us in Michigan to write 100-word poems. And I was walking on Belle Isle one March day, and it had been a cold winter. We haven't had one since that has had as much ice on the lakes. So it was sunny, and I heard this noise, and I didn't know what I was listening to, but it was the ice breaking up. So, Ice Music. Ice melt, ice lace, ice breaking up upstream, coming down from up north in variegated quilts of flows. No instance act this crumbling. An entire season sends broken continents our way. Once miles wide chunks break and bob or push up against the shore in spun sugar turrets, they rise, fall, glistening, dissolving. Ice lace, ice music. I seem to hear a tremolo in the trees, but it's March, no leaves, no breeze, just the score for the scene before me, silvery glissandos rising from a streaming swarm of glinting creatures herded by the current in a living, touching, clinking, singing surge.
The voice of Terry Blackhawk. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witterbinner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional funding by Friend of Poetry, Hiram LaRue. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.